This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Two different interpretations of the Affordable Care Act have raised questions about whether some states can give out subsidies to help people pay for health insurance. The D.C. Circuit Court ruled yesterday that subsidies are illegal in states that did not set up their own insurance exchanges. North Carolina is one of those states. Then hours later, the Fourth Circuit Court said they are legal. Joining us now from Washington to talk about what the rulings mean for North Carolina, both now and in the future, is Neil Siegel. He's a professor at the Duke University Law School. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you. Greetings to you and to my family in Durham.
Well, welcome back as soon as you can. But I understand things are, you know, you've got things to do up there in D.C., and that's an important place to be these days. The argument apparently hinges on differences in healthcare exchanges, right? That, and maybe we should go back. We should go back to healthcare exchanges themselves. People go to the to get insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Remind us why some states did set up their own and others did not.
Well, the statute, the Affordable Care Act, gives states the choice. They can set up their own exchange, and if they don't want to, the federal government is then directed to set it up in their stead. Now, the statute says that the federal government will operate such exchange if the states don't. And you have right now 16 states in D.C. That have set up their own exchanges, and the rest, 34 states, that are have the federal government running the exchanges. So whether the subsidies are available in the federally owned exchanges affects whether millions of Americans in 34 states are going to have access to the subsidies that make insurance affordable. Different states have decided not to set up exchanges for different reasons. Some of it is ideological opposition to this law and not wanting to be any part of helping to implement it or helping it to succeed. Other states may have had, you know, concerns about the financing of the and the administrative costs of running the exchange. I don't think any state official that was deciding whether or not to set up an exchange thought that these tax subsidies hung in the balance. I think this was really news to Congress. It was news to the state officials that had to make this decision.
Well, and interestingly enough, the reason they hang in the balance is because, as you said, the law itself allows the option of either the state doing it or or you can work through the federal government. So in one part of the bill or one part of the law now, you have this option that's set up. But then in another part where we talk about who is eligible, it says, quote, subsidies are available to people who are enrolled through an exchange established by the state, unquote. And so tell us about that particular phrase and how that became the source of attention for the D.C. Circuit and the Fourth Circuit.
Right. So here's the thing. It doesn't use that phrase, an exchange established by the state, in determining who's eligible. In determining who's eligible for the subsidies, it makes no distinction between whether you get your insurance through a state-run exchange or a federally-run exchange. Rather, that phrase comes up in a place you wouldn't expect it if you thought anything turned on the distinction. It comes up in the part of the law that determines how to calculate the amount of a subsidy, not who's eligible. And in determining the amount of the subsidy, the law says that it'll be calculated in part based on the cost of a premium that was secured in an exchange established by the state. And so the argument of the challengers is that according to the plain meaning of those words, in order to get the subsidy, the exchange has to have been established by the state. That's the language that the challengers want the courts to focus in on like a laser. And the government says, well, you've got to read a statute in context and as a whole. That language about establishing an exchange, about calculating these subsidies based upon the cost of a premium in an exchange established by the state, occurs in a part of the statute that says the states are going to establish an exchange. And in fact, defines an exchange as a term of art in the statute, as an exchange established by the state. It's then in the subsequent part of the statute that makes clear that the states have an option and that if the states don't establish the exchange, the federal government will operate such exchange. And in fact, another part of the statute requires the different exchanges, both federal and state, to report what kinds of subsidies the individuals in those exchanges are getting. And the government says it wouldn't make much sense to impose that reporting requirement on the federal government if, in fact, the federally run exchanges did not make the subsidies available. So you have a disagreement here about the statutory language as well as whether to look at one phrase in particular or to look at the surrounding statutory context.
Well, let's focus on that for just a moment because, as you say, clearly it's the intent of the law to offer the subsidies to people in either case. But you can, if you focus on that one phrase, you would come up with a different conclusion as the D.C. Circuit did. How apparently the court has flexibility to choose to interpret just a phrase or see it as part of a whole. Am I right?
Well, as a matter of law power, then yes, you're right. They have flexibility, and there are ways of coming out either way. If you're asking me, as a matter of legal craft and argument, are both arguments just as good as the other, then my professional judgment would be no. I mean, if, in order for the challengers to win, it's not just the case that they have the better argument on balance, but that the statute clearly and unambiguously accomplished what no one in Congress or the states thought had happened, namely limited the subsidies to the states that established their own exchanges. The reason I say it has to be clearly clear and ambiguous is because there's a doctrine of administrative law called the Chevron Doctrine, which says that when a statute is ambiguous, then the courts are obliged to defer to a reasonable interpretation of the statute by the administrative agency charged with interpreting it and with implementing it. And here that's the IRS and the HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services. And they both agree through this regulation that's at issue that individuals should have access to the subsidies regardless of which exchange they have the good fortune of enrolling in. And so I think at the very least, the statute is ambiguous. And for the D.C. Circuit panel majority to have concluded that it is unambiguous, it's crystal clear that the statute contains a poison pill that threatens to blow up the statute and destabilize the insurance market, strikes me as really is quite implausible.
Well, but your judgment notwithstanding, that is what the court did, and that is in D.C. It turns out where it was ruled illegal on those grounds.
Right.
Here in the 4th District, that court found that it is still, the statute still stands. North Carolina is in the 4th District. So what does this conflict mean for people in North Carolina who have subsidies now without a state exchange?
Right. So the panel majority in the D.C. Circuit ruled 2-1 that the subsidies were not available in the federally run exchanges. And the 3-judge panel in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 4th Circuit in Richmond, which covers North Carolina, ruled that the subsidies were available in states that have federally facilitated exchanges like North Carolina. So for the time being, I think the status quo is going to remain in effect. You're going to have individuals in North Carolina who qualify for the subsidies are going to be able to get them, notwithstanding the fact that the federal government is running the exchanges. I expect the plaintiffs, those challenging the law in Virginia, to seek Supreme Court review immediately, not ask the 4th Circuit to rehear the case as a whole court, to rehear the case en banc. And so we'll see if the U.S. Supreme Court wants to take that case. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruling would bind the nation.
Is that likely, given the conflict in these two rulings?
Well, a split of authority on an important question of federal law, a circuit split, is the classic reason for the U.S. Supreme Court to hear a case, to grant cert under Supreme Court Rule 10. But there is not yet a circuit split because the government has announced that it's going to seek rehearing en banc in the D.C. Circuit.
Which means what?
Which means that the government's going to ask the full D.C. Circuit to rehear the case. And if the D.C. Circuit decides to rehear the case, I think it's much more likely than not that they're going to get rid of this panel decision and the D.C. Circuit's going to decide the case the same way that the 4th Circuit did.
If you live in that area covered by the D.C. Circuit, what happens to you now in that area that it has been declared illegal, given the fact that the government has asked for this new hearing?
I think for the time being, the panel majority opinion in the D.C. Circuit is stayed. It doesn't go into effect while the full D.C. Circuit decides whether or not they're going to rehear the case in bank. And so for the time being, I think the status quo remains in effect. The question will the U.S. Supreme Court grant cert in this King case, the 4th Circuit case? Will the D.C. Circuit rehear the case in bank? If not, will the U.S. Supreme Court take that case? So for the time being, the government is going to continue to issue the subsidies, and the D.C. Circuit opinion is not going to go into effect. But that window is limited, and it's going to depend upon what the full D.C. Circuit does, and most importantly, what the U.S. Supreme Court does.
If the D.C. Circuit opinion is upheld and it becomes essentially the final say on this, it essentially undoes the Affordable Care Act, doesn't it?
Well, the image that comes to mind is that scene at the end of Star Wars where Luke Skywalker has to make the perfect shot to blow up the Death Star, right? I mean, this is that perfect shot that threatens to blow up the Affordable Care Act. I think specifically what it means is that there are about 7 to 10 million people who are expected eventually to get their insurance through federally run exchanges. Without the subsidies, a good number of them are either not going to be able to afford insurance and they're going to have to pay the tax penalty, or they're not going to qualify for this. If they don't have the subsidies, they're going to qualify for a financial hardship exemption, which means if you take them out of the subsidies, you take them out of the requirement to get insurance. And that's the concern, is that's what's going to really destabilize the insurance markets, because the insurance companies are still required to cover people regardless of pre-existing conditions, regardless of medical history. And without some kind of requirement to get insurance ahead of time, the concern is that people are going to have a perverse incentive to wait until they're sick or injured to get insurance.
All right, Neil Siegel, thank you very much. We're out of time, but I appreciate your time. Neil Siegel, a law professor at Duke University. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we preview an exhibit at the Durham History Hub about a turn-of-the-century photographer, Hugh Mangum, on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.